But then I decided it was a bit of a long sitter and very deep, and went through various short sitters and thought they're not so deep and they're a bit short, and managed to find one that sort of stands between the two. It's a little bit longer than usual, so I may read the whole thing, probably. Is that the best method for everyone there? Read it through. And then we can start to look at each section in a bit more detail and see what comes through. So this is somewhat related to the first one I found, which was about practicing for the revulsion and fading away of the five khandhas. So that means of body, of feeling, of perception, of volition or mental volitional activity, and of consciousness. And this was very interesting because how many of us practice for that? Or do we practice for the peace, the joy, the happiness? Of course, that comes as a result, but it's very clearly stated that the person who's practicing for the fading away, first of all, the turning away, then the fading away is a natural consequence, and the cessation is practicing correctly. But the one I found is related because it's called escape. And it's talking about how we can escape from the things that bind us, but also focuses on their opposites, almost as an alternative, right, to getting lost in the things that are no good for us. So this is probably a little bit more uplifting to read and talks about some of the immediate benefits of escaping from the things that are harmful. So it is the Anguttara Fives. I'll type it in the chat because Matthias is not here. Well, he is, but he's on my side. So it's Anguttara 5, number 200. So if you do want to follow along, you're welcome. But again, it's not really a sutta class. It's not that I have all the answers and I'm going to tell you how to think about this. It's a discussion opportunity to see how it might relate to our lives and hopefully to share your own reflections. So help me out because I am a little bit tired. So I will do my best to bring you out of your sleepiness through the Buddha's words. Good. So, and again, as usual, where the texts say bhikkhu, I will say either monastic, if it's very clearly addressing monastics, or just community. So just consider that this is being addressed to us all, because the Buddha taught for the benefit of all. So, community, there are these five elements of escape. What five? So here it doesn't mean escapism. It just means escaping from, again, the things that are suffering, the things that are harmful. And the Pali word for that is nisarana, which is a very beautiful word and a word that's often taken by monastics. They call themselves Venerable Nissarana or Nissarano. So what five? Number one, here, when a person is attending to sensual pleasures, their mind does not launch out upon them and become placid, settled, and focused on them. But when they are attending to renunciation, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed. I'm just going to pause there because I found that word a little strange. And in the commentary, it says, in the footnotes, it says, basically that means it's gone away from that unwholesome aspect of the mind. So it's actually turned away from the sensual pleasures. That's what it means here by well departed. Well developed, well emerged, well liberated, and well detached from sensual pleasures. And one is free from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with sensual pleasures as condition. One does not feel that kind of feeling. This is declared to be the escape from sensual pleasures. I'm tempted to already pause here just to see if anything is confusing in the language being used or needs further clarity, because we're going to repeat the same kind of formulation for different qualities. So there'll be five different ones. So Just let me know if anything needs a little bit more unpacking straight away. Otherwise, we can continue and hopefully the meaning will become clear. Everyone's okay so far? Yes. All right. So number two, the second element of escape. Again, when a person is attending to ill will, their mind does not launch out upon it and become placid, settled, and focused on it. But when they're attending to goodwill, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed or has gone away from that ill will, well developed, well emerged, and well liberated, and well detached from ill will. And they are freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with ill will as condition. They do not feel that kind of feeling. This is declared to be the escape from ill will. Number three, again, when a person is attending to harming, their mind does not launch out upon it and become placid, settled, and focused on it. But when they're attending to non-harming, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed, well developed, well emerged, well liberated, and well detached from harming. And they're freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with harming as condition. They do not feel that kind of feeling. This is declared to be the escape from harming. Number four, again, when a person is attending to form, their mind does not launch out upon it and become placid, settled, and focused on it. But when they're attending to the formless, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed, well developed, well emerged, well liberated, and well detached from form. And they are freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with form as a condition. They do not feel that kind of feeling. This is declared to be the escape from form. Number five, again, when a bhikkhu or a person or a monastic is attending to personal existence, their mind does not launch out upon it and become placid, settled, and focused on it. But when they are attending to the cessation of personal existence, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed, well developed, well emerged, well liberated, and well detached from personal existence. And they're freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with personal existence as a condition. They do not feel that feeling. This is declared to be the escape from personal existence. Okay, so before we summarize, I'm just going to come to Chi, who's just put her hand up. So I'll come to you and then I'll finish this. Yeah.
It's just a tiny technical question. Where the word formless is used, is that like any particular like Pali word that it's referring to when it says formless?
I haven't looked at the Pali because I didn't have the time to do that, but I'm pretty sure the word would be arupa. So rupa would be normally used for form, and then arupa is the opposite. So that could also refer to states where the body, the form, the gross form is present, and states where it's absent. So for example, in the formless states, they're not actually called the jhanas, the formless jhanas, they're called the arupas, simply the arupa states, formless states in the suttas. So I think it's talking about that. Yeah, and it might include states of existence that are beyond form as well. So some of the realms where beings exist without this coarse material body. That is my guess with that. So is there any other language there? Okay, Arupe, yeah. That's the word we want. Thank you very much for putting the Pali in so quickly. Anything else that's just technical before we get into a lot of discussion around this? Yes.
I'm curious about the translation personal existence.
Personal existence, yeah. So yeah.
Whoever found that translation.
Yeah. Could you please put that in as well, Kaz? That would be wonderful. The next little paragraph, the personal existence, which I'm guessing is like Sakaya, but I might be wrong. Yeah, if you can, that would be wonderful. So I'm just giving one moment. I'll come to you, Joseph, after that, if that's okay, because I let's just have a look. Punna chaparam bhikkave bhikkhuno sakkayam. So sakkaya. Yeah, like sakkaya ditti. So personal existence is a translation. I don't, but when they're attending to goodwill, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed or has gone away from that ill will, well developed, well emerged, and well liberated, and well detached from ill will. And they are freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with ill will as condition. They do not feel that kind of feeling. This is declared to be the escape from ill will. Number three, again, when a person is attending to harming, their mind does not launch out upon it and become placid, settled, and focused on it. But when they're attending to non-harming, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed, well developed, well emerged, well liberated, and well detached from harming. And they're freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with harming as condition. They do not feel that kind of feeling. This is declared to be the escape from harming. Number four, again, when a person is attending to form, their mind does not launch out upon it and become placid, settled, and focused on it. But when they're attending to the formless, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed, well developed, well emerged, well liberated, and well detached from form. And they are freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with form as a condition. They do not feel that kind of feeling. This is declared to be the escape from form. Number five, again, when a bhikkhu or a person or a monastic is attending to personal existence, their mind does not launch out upon it and become placid, settled, and focused on it. But when they are attending to the cessation of personal existence, their mind launches out upon it and becomes placid, settled, and focused on it. Their mind is well departed, well developed, well emerged, well liberated, and well detached from personal existence. And they're freed from those taints, distressful and feverish, that arise with personal existence as a condition. They do not feel that feeling. This is declared to be the escape from personal existence. Okay, so before we summarize, I'm just going to come to Chi, who's just put her hand up. So I'll come to you and then I'll finish this. Yeah.
It's just a teeny tiny technical question. Where the word formless is used, is that like any particular like Pali word that it's referring to when it says formless?
Formless. I haven't looked at the Pali because I didn't have the time to do that, but I'm pretty sure the word would be arupa. So rupa would be normally used for form, and then arupa is the opposite. So that could also refer to states where the body, the form, the gross form is present and states where it's absent. So, for example, in the formless states, they're not actually called the jhanas, the formless jhanas. They're called the arupas, simply the arupa states, formless states in the suttas. So I think it's talking about that. Yeah, and it might include states of existence that are beyond form as well. So some of the realms where beings exist without this coarse material body. That is my guess with that. So is there any other language there? Okay, arupe, yeah. That's the word we want. Thank you very much for putting the Pali in so quickly. Anything else that's just technical before we get into a lot of discussion around this? Yes.
I'm curious about the translation personal existence.
Personal existence, yeah. So yeah.
Whoever found that translation.
Yeah. Could you please put that in as well, Kaz? That would be wonderful. The next little paragraph, the personal existence, which I'm guessing is like Sakaya, but I might be wrong. Yeah. If you can, that would be wonderful. So I'm just giving one moment. I'll come to you, Joseph, after that, if that's okay, because I let's just have a look. Punna chapram bhikkave bhikkhuno sakkayam. So sakkaya. Yeah, like sakkaya ditti. So personal existence is a translation. I don't particularly like that translation, Sakaya. It's usually more like a view of the personality. Like, I mean, it's okay. It's kind of taking existence to be personal or taking oneself to be, to have inherent existence, let's say. If that makes sense. I'll come to you, Joseph, if it's a technical question, but if it's a question that wants more discussion, I'll come afterwards. So I'll just come to you because I want to finish the sutta first. Would you be okay to wait? Yeah? Yeah? All right. Okay, Bhante Sujata says substantial reality. Yeah. I'm not so keen on a lot of Bhante Sujata's translations. I'm not going to, maybe I will tell him that when he's here. But some of them I like and other ones I'm not really keen on because it's not really about whether it's substantial or not. I mean, whether it's substantial or insubstantial, it's still non-self. So I'm not sure what he means by substantial reality. I mean, you wouldn't say you're overcoming substantial reality belief. And it is the same word that, you know, as the fetta sakaya ditti, which is belief in a self, basically, personality view, sometimes people call it, or self view. Substantial reality sounds incredibly technical and confusing to me, very vague. But it's good to have the other translations because they help to shed light on, you know, these words, and then we can maybe come closer to what resonates for us. Yeah. So I don't want to get too much into the Pali. A few people have put the other translations. Feel free to read them if you wish. If not, I'll continue. This okay, so the Tanisaro's one says self-identity. Yeah, that's good too. But identity view is another one. Personality view, identity. Yeah, self-identity. Yeah. Sakaya ditti is self-identity view. Yeah. When it has ditti, it's view. Without ditti, it's just self-identity, personality, view of self. I think you get the drift. So it basically means the view of a worldling or the view of the area. So I'm not sure if Joseph wanted to, I don't know what I've done now. Ask a technical question. I think I've done full screen.
My question is revolving around deepening my understanding of renunciation and what sensual pleasures mean. Is now an appropriate time to talk about that? Would you like to wait?
That's quite a long discussion. Let's get onto that after I finish the sutta, because I think we'll go back to that probably from the beginning. And we probably won't get to finish the sutta if I go into that now, because I'm sure there's a lot to say. Okay. So we've gone through the five elements of escape. So now there's a little summary at the end. Delight in sensual pleasures does not lie within one. Delight in ill will does not lie within one. Delight in harming does not lie within one. Delight in form does not lie within one. Delight in personal existence, or if you like, self-identity, or it really means the existence of a self, doesn't it? Or the view of existence of a self does not lie within one. Because they are without the underlying tendencies towards delight in sensual pleasures, delight in ill will, delight in harming, delight in form, and delight in personal existence, one is called a person devoid of underlying tendencies. So this is now the arahat. So we've skipped from observing these unwholesome states and purifying the mind through these five escapes. One has cut off craving, stripped off the fetter, and by completely breaking through conceit, one has made an end of suffering. These are the five elements of escape. Oh, there we go. And there probably is a lot to unpack, but one of the things that stood out to me whilst reading this was that in a sense, we could see it as a description of somebody's practice, or we could also see it as an instruction. And I think as a description, it's interesting because it's showing us where this leads to. But as an instruction, it's maybe a bit more relevant to most of us who are not at the stage where we've abandoned, launching out upon sensual pleasures. I love this phrase, launching out. It's one of the reasons I chose the sutta, because I thought it was so descriptive. You know, how many times does something arise in the mind and we literally kind of get lured towards it and our mind kind of goes, yeah, let's go with this, you know, and before we know it, we're completely swept away. So, and the other thing I wanted to mention about that particular sentence, the very first one in the sequence, when a person is attending to sensual pleasures, their mind does not launch out upon them and become placid, settled, and focused on them. So it's not only that it doesn't launch out, you can actually be aware of the sensual pleasure, you can attend to it in order to investigate it, but not in order to get swept away with it. There's a very... there's a distinction there. So you have a choice in a sense. You can observe whether the mind launches out or not. But where it says it does not become placid, settled, or focused on them, I doubt that it's even possible to become placid and settled whilst having sensual pleasures in mind, right? So that's almost like a law of nature, I think. Whereas one is talking about the behavior of somebody's mind, the next part of the sentence to me seems to be saying that you cannot become settled and placid. Maybe you can become focused on sensual pleasures, but further on in the paragraph, it says that those taints are distressful and feverish. So they actually are the complete opposite of qualities that are going to lead to placidity of mind and the settling of mind. Because placidity and settling of mind is also a description of deep states of meditation, deep states of samadhi. It means states that are free, relatively free from hindrances. So I think I'll make one more little point, which is that it's interesting here that it's also talking about how our mind starts to behave. Like if we see this more of as a description, we're seeing that rather than getting swept away or launching out upon, say, ill will. Instead, we attend to goodwill and the mind launches out upon that. So it's to me a sign that we're starting to recondition our mind in a way that the mind becomes attracted to where its true benefit lies. It actually is developing some wisdom and it much more frequently starts to turn towards the opposites. And at the same time, until we have practiced that or until we're at that point, we can actually use these opposites as ways to overcome the negative. So in one of the suttas, I think it's the Advaita Vitaka Sutta in Majjhima 19, it talks about unwholesome thoughts, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of sensuality, and thoughts of harming, which is the first three of these, right? And the antidote to thoughts of ill will are thoughts of loving kindness. The antidote to thoughts of desire are thoughts of renunciation, just like here, that's the escape. And of course, the antidote to thoughts of harming are thoughts of compassion, or if you like, non-harming. Thoughts of gentleness, thoughts of harmlessness, thoughts of mercy towards living beings. Yeah. So our mind becomes increasingly drawn towards those antidotes. You know, we put them in place and then over time we develop the habits so that our mind is much more likely to move in that direction and finds that placidity, that settledness and that focus so we can stay with these wholesome states for much longer periods of time. So having said that, I would like to open up for discussion, and I'm going to come to Joseph first because he already had his hand up a while ago and then I'll come, I think Benjamin had his hand up too. If you can keep it up, it's great because it just helps me not to have to hold it in mind. And then I will come to some of the comments in the chat. Okay. Hi, Joseph. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Venerable. So I find my mind appreciates concrete examples, like visual examples. So in terms of renunciation, really trying to understand what that looks like. I'll give an example from today. So I was volunteering at the food bank today and the thought arose, well, maybe I can go out and get a biscuit for lunch, even though I had food available at the food bank. They were serving meals at the back. And so I found that I had to apply perceptions of, repulsive, or like just like think about kind of not attacking, not disliking the biscuit, but just kind of watching the biscuit kind of disintegrate in my mind, the perception of biscuit. And then I found I could let it go. But what arose, and then, oh, that's helpful. I don't want the biscuit anymore. That's quite delightful. The feeling of not wanting the biscuit was very wholesome. But my question is, I notice sometimes you mention that the suttas are for the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
And what question that arises in my mind is, how are lay people able to completely renounce the sensual pleasures of eating, because I have to feed myself, and then the monks don't have to feed themselves, right? So that's kind of in a dilemma. That's kind of like a mental, don't know how to get out of that thought pattern. Does that make sense?
Kind of, but we do have to feed ourselves. And sometimes there's a whole lot of choice, you know, for us to choose from on the table. So yeah, it's true that maybe not so much thought goes into the preparation of the food, but certainly a lot of greed can arise when walking through the alms line. So it's a practice for monastics as much as it is for lay people, I would say. And if you would ever come to Bodhinyana Monastery, I think, haven't you been there? Actually, and have you seen how much dessert there is? There's a whole table. Like there's a whole, a table of 2 or 3 meters, right? Just with desserts, 3 meters easily. So I see the greed arising in people on alms around there, and it's something that we have to observe. I mean, I like in this sutta that it talks about a person is attending to sensual pleasures, and it actually says a bhikkhu is attending to sensual pleasures. So nobody starts out without these desires. We all start out with, you know, sensuality, with ill will, with tendencies towards harming, if not other beings overtly, certainly harming ourselves and harming others by the way we think. So I like this sutta because it's very practical. It's saying that there are times that we have to attend to these. But it's talking about skillful ways of attending, which is, I think, what you did in the example today. You noticed it arising and then you attended to it. You noticed, okay, this sensual pleasure is actually not helping me. So that was a kind of attention, a kind of wisdom arising. And then you were wise enough to see how it arose and to see how it could be abandoned by cultivating thoughts of letting go or renunciation. So I think that's a great example. And when you were speaking about that example, I thought, wow, it's different from the example I saw today, which was two dogs, one of our supporters, and we got out biscuits for the dogs. And those dogs definitely didn't have any thoughts of renunciation. They only had thoughts of desire and thoughts of, I think, not ill will, actually. They let each other eat their respective biscuits, which was very nice. But one of the dogs was barking and, you know, very, very impatient to be fed. So it was quite a nice example in contrast to what I saw today. And I think that's, you know, the faculty that we have as human beings. We're not swept away. We don't have to be swept by our desires. So I would also just say, you know, don't worry too much about the kind of desires that are not going to lead to abject harm for anyone. If you eat a little bit too much, it's not going to stop you gaining insight and, you know, gradually reducing the defilements. The kind of sensuality that is harmful is the kind that would entail breaking our precepts, entail harming another, you know, maybe, you know, sleeping with someone who is already in a relationship, or, you know, betraying somebody, or stealing, you know, all of this kind of sensuality that's very obviously harmful. So don't worry too much about that. We need to be nourished. We need to be healthy. And I find it really helpful to be grateful for the food I get. Because when I lived in Myanmar, we used to chant this little thing before the meal that actually said, I eat this food which is disgusting in nature, as we were looking in our bowl. And I really started to struggle with the food. I mean, I was ill. I could barely eat anything before I actually left. I was eating like 2 or 3 teaspoons of something per day, and it was all coming back. I couldn't even swallow it. I mean, I was really ill. And I'm not saying that is what caused it, but I don't think it helped. So be grateful for the food and just keep a watch on your mind. Yeah. Thanks for the question. I love the example. Benjamin, did you have something?
Hello.
Hi.
When we got to when a person is attending to harming, I started thinking, I wonder exactly what attending to is supposed to mean. Because when a bhikkhu is attending to harming, makes it sound as though the bhikkhu has some harming to do, so he goes and does it. I found a footnote on this, which explained that, but brought up another question. Because the footnotes implies that the attending to in the sutta is contemplating having just been in jhanas.
So
then the question is, is it different for those of us who don't regularly get into jhanas? And if so,
absolutely. And I don't know where they're getting that from in the commentaries. I mean, sometimes the commentaries, they're written by people, practitioners, I hope, but not necessarily, possibly scholars. And there's no hint that that's the case in the sutta itself. There's no suggestion of that. But I do think there's the implication, or the sort of we can infer that if somebody is attending to it in a way that does not mean they're launching out upon it, that they're not getting completely overwhelmed by it either. And of course, if somebody has just come out of jhana, I mean, I find that almost impossible to believe, because one thing is, I don't think it would arise, you know, not for days, actually. If it really is a jhana, then the five hindrances have been really knocked out for quite a significant period of time, both in the jhana but afterwards as well. And yeah, so I don't even know that it did arise. And if it would arise, well, certainly it would be nipped in the bud very fast. So yeah, I mean, you know, the practice of meditation, and the deeper that it goes, the more and more we're conditioning our mind to turn away from those defilements, see them, spot them early, and quickly nip them in the bud. And develop more and more inclination to go back to those peaceful states. So I think it is encouraging us to do that, but there's no mention here of John and Paul. So, yeah, I sort of didn't bother to write that part down because of that. But I did write down the part that said attending to might mean you're aware, you're investigating it, you're investigating how it arises, etc. And I think that would be what would prevent us from launching out upon it. In other words, being completely taken with it and forgetting ourselves for maybe minutes, maybe hours. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. All right. I'll come to the chat and then I'll go to Shirley. So around the personality view or the self-identity, existence is not a reality but a dream. Once someone awakens, they awaken from the dream of existence. I don't know. Is that a view? Does the Buddha say that? I'm not sure about that. I think I know what you're getting at. It maybe isn't the way we think it is, but it isn't exactly nothing either. The Buddha said that, you know, it is real to the extent that whatever we're experiencing right now has arisen, but it's also not permanent because it can pass away. So it's not that there's nothing there, but it's that what is there is not what we take it to be. It's something else. We take it to be a self. We take it to be permanent. We take it to be mine. We take it to be enduring, you know, and our real identity. And yeah, there's a lot of delusion in that. Perhaps it's delusion that makes us sort of live in a dream. But the actual, there is something there. And that's what we need to develop insight into. Develop insight into the process of basically dependent origination. Yeah. Someone else is saying conventional reality, then absolute reality. To use a chair may seem like a real thing, but it's only parts put together in a chair. So we assume this body in the sense of the self, but it isn't so. Yeah, but do we really know it? Do we really know it? It's a good analogy. Conventional absolute are from the Abhidhamma, I think. So they're not actually used that way in the suttas very often. But there is a beautiful sutta in the Bhikkhuni Samyutta. And I always forget which bhikkhuni it was. Was it Soma or was it someone else? It might be Bhikkhuni Soma, and she was fully enlightened. Whoever it was, she compared the body to being like a chariot put together in different parts. How can you say this part of the chariot is me or that part of the chariot is me? It's only when it comes together that we can say this is a person. So, yeah, I mean, we have to relate to one another as people who have feelings and who, you know, who have wishes and hopes and aspirations and a lot of suffering most of the time, so that we can develop compassion and we can learn to treat each other gently and kindly. But at the same time, understand that, you know, who we're relating to is not fixed. And that can also free up a lot more compassion when we realize this person in front of me is actually, you know, a sum total of every condition that they've experienced, all the conditions that have, you know, whether it's nourishing conditions or difficulties and pains, opportunities, lack of opportunities. So that's why they're presenting the way they do. It's not because they're worse than us or better than us or more confident than us. It's that they've had conditions that have led to that confidence or led to that, whatever it is we see. So, yeah, they're not self, body and senses, not only body and senses, body and mind. Five khandhas are not self. Let the Dhamma speak, not the sensual pleasures. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. And the last little question in the box. It seems actually very simple unless I'm missing something. If you feel anger or lost or whatever, focus on the opposite emotional behavior. So water the flowers and not the weeds. Yeah, if only we could remember that, right? In theory, the Dhamma is very simple, very clear. But the problem is that when we do feel anger or lost or whatever, we get swept away with it. And at that moment, it feels very valid. You know, you really think that there's going to be happiness if we follow the loss. There's, you know, a real justification for our anger. We really think that, and that's why we get swept away and we miss the arising of the anger, the arising of the lust and the suffering it creates. And we blame the person outside, you know, we blame the object for our anger or for our lust. So, yeah, in theory, it is simple to a degree, but to move from observing anger or lust arising to cultivating the opposite emotion is not always enough. That's part of right effort, the sixth factor of the path. But we also need wisdom and very strong mindfulness to actually start to see how these things are arising. So I don't know. In this sutta, it seems to me that it's talking about both. Because we're not just talking about immediately switching from the ill will to the goodwill. We're actually saying we are attending to it, but we don't go, we don't follow it. And it's, yeah, again, it's is it an instruction or is it a description? Or just to notice the difference, you know, when we focus on ill will as opposed to goodwill. Yeah. I have to go in order, so I'll come to Shirley and you just keep your hand up and I'll come.
No question, come just back. Relating to what she said, a little bit, just a good comment.
Go on.
Just like from personal experience, I know how difficult it is, like especially with anger, because it's so repetitive.
Yeah.
It's like a revolving door, like you can kind of subdue it and like say, okay, let me be mindful, let me console it, and then 2 minutes later, it's
yeah,
it regenerates.
It re-arises.
And you can do that for weeks if you.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's really true, and especially if you're not cultivating the opposite, and that's why the practice of loving kindness, not just when you have the anger. In fact, sometimes it's easier to practice loving kindness when you don't have anger, and you make that very, very strong, and that actually prevents the arising of ill will next time, or it lessens the likelihood for it to arise. Yeah. So Shirley, thank you.
Okay. I raised my hand after Benjamin's little reflection and question, because it was very much connected with that, because I was intrigued by the same bit.
Mm.
There's going to be a question, there's going to be a bit of a reflection. So it seems to me that he is actually recommending that when all these negative mind states arise, such as ill will or sensuality or self-identification with the self, that we actually examine this with wise reflection rather than immediately leap to the opposite. Mm. So I'm not quite sure I go with what Dee said. But what I don't get is that it says, I can't understand how, if one does that, one's placid and settled and focused. I don't see how that is. So, because one isn't placid if you're embroiled with sensual pleasures.
Yeah.
So I don't know what he means by placid. You can be settled and focused or stuck on them. So I'm just wondering what the Pali is for placid, because it's none of those states are placid, as you said.
Right. But it's actually saying they're not. It's not saying they are. So here it's actually saying the mind does not launch out on it and become placid, settled and focused.
Right, okay. It's a bit of a weird way of...
Awkward English, actually. Yeah. It's awkward language.
But my reflection is that he's really asking us to reflect on the sort of heat and of these states. And the interesting bit about, I mean, not that I've ever experienced jhana, I don't think, but when the mind is actually full of kindness or full of renunciation, or actually is able to let go of identifying with all the things that come and go, that is so remarkably peaceful.
Yeah.
And I think if one can actually really focus on how good that feels and how bad it feels, then it's a lot easier. And I think that's what it's probably about.
Yeah.
So So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. I would completely agree with everything you said, actually. And yes, the language is beautiful. I mean, in the first sentence, it is a clunky sentence, so it's, you know, not immediately obvious that he's saying the mind will not become, it does not become placid, settled and focused. But that's in contrast, I think, to, you know, how it is if the mind is full of harmlessness, goodwill, etc., like you say, and those words become very beautiful, right? Becoming placid, settled and focused on goodwill, placid, settled and focused on harmlessness. And then comparing that to what he talks about as the taints that are distressful and feverish. It's very descriptive, isn't it? I mean, how many of us feel the fever and the distress of sensual pleasure, sensuality when it arises? Sometimes we get intoxicated and completely, deceived by it. And we don't feel it at that moment as feverish. I remember when I was doing a lot of Vipassana meditation and staying with sensations and the speed of their arising and passing throughout the day and sometimes throughout the night. And sometimes things would arise, like a little bit of sensual pleasure, or not pleasure, like craving. And I remember once having this really quite strongly and noticing a sense of very strong nibbida arise alongside it. And I guess the description that came to mind was like really bittersweet and really agitating, like burning. And if we're honest to these things, we can actually experience it that way. It's actually quite unpleasant, quite the opposite of being placid and settled, isn't it? Yeah. Can I just come to the chat, because this is still related and I think this is, I'd also quite agree. I find that trying to focus on the opposite when a negative state arises can create resistance in the mind, which can build up. It seems too forceful a method, at least for me. I find it more helpful to try and come back to the middle. Yeah, and the Buddha isn't expressly saying when it arises, practice goodwill instead. That is there a little bit in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta. He's sort of saying when thoughts of ill will arise, it's in the next sutta, the Majjhima 20. So the five types of thought, the first one is substitution. So when a thought of ill will arises, substitute it with a thought of goodwill. But he doesn't always suggest this. That's only one of the methods. And some of them are just sitting back and allowing the kind of energy of that to abate. So there are different methods at different times. And I think it's great that we're talking about this, because we're getting into our own personal practice and what works for us. And it's different for different people. So, yeah, I find the same. I mean, if I would try to immediately shift from what I'm feeling into something else, that would feel very constructed and forceful, because it would be, in a sense, I think it's difficult to be sure that you're not moving away through aversion. To me, it's first about noticing something arise, trying to find a way to stay with it that's not feeding it. So maybe that means developing peace towards it, developing equanimity, developing more spaciousness with it, or even smiling at it, even having a sense of loving kindness towards it. So rather than actually change your mind state from ill will to goodwill, but you can still have, in a way, a kind of attitude to it. And that, but not to get rid of it, to actually understand it, to help you understand it. And in that awareness itself, it starts to fade away. Because when we realize, luckily we've got this faculty as human beings, when we realize that something hurts, we tend to drop it eventually. It's just that our wisdom faculty can be a little bit slow. Yeah, so I think that's really good. Yeah, back to the middle, I think you are pointing to equanimity there. Yeah. I agree and think there can be some sort of spiritual bypass. I find it good to remind myself of a time when I was free from that negative state and practice self-compassion in relation to that state. Yeah, great. Okay, so there's a lot happening in the discussion in the chat, but I'll come to Suzanne next if you still have a question, and then we'll come back to the chat. Can you unmute?
Hello. Hi. Well, I actually was putting my hand down again because I was just, it has been said a few times now that you know, about the attending to it first would be really important and not just switching. Mm. I don't think it even works to just So it has been said. So I feel like that too. I practice like that.
Yeah.
And I find it also like all these attachments and all the suffering. I mean, that's what really is the way to understand what's going on, you know, myself and the world. So I wouldn't want to miss out on it.
Yeah, great. Yeah. I like that you did make another nuance point, because sometimes we think it's been said, but we have our own way of phrasing things. And you said, oh, I don't even think it's possible to do that. And that's true when you're in the middle of it. It's, you know, often not possible. If it was, we wouldn't have anything arising, any defilements arising, right? Or any unwholesome, unwanted states arising. However, I do think there's something to be said for the comment around watering the flowers, because it doesn't mean you do that at that time necessarily. It means that you have your whole life to practice, right? And some of the time we're going into whatever's arising that's difficult, but some of the time we're feeling good in the day, and it might be a good time to actually practice thoughts of loving kindness, or practice some breath meditation or something to calm the mind so that we cultivate those strengths as well. So really it's about context and about trying to develop an all-rounded practice. And I've noticed that, you know, making loving kindness a key part of my practice in and of itself, not just at the end of a meditation, but to practice meditation as the metta, as the main meditation from time to time, gives me, it inclines the mind towards loving kindness, so that I'm more likely to have the attitudes of loving kindness coming up throughout the day, and the attitudes of loving kindness even when unpleasant states arise. So I do think there's, you know, he's pointing to practicing both ways. Yeah. So goodbye, Karen, if you haven't already left. Someone's leaving now. And another comment in the chat. I find that acknowledging what state I'm in and practicing compassion to myself for feeling what I feel is helping find peace with the situation. Definitely, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting, actually, when we think about, say, finding peace, finding the middle point, developing equanimity. In my practice, you know, with Goenka, which was very many years, like probably the first 15 at least years of my practice life, equanimity was the main sort of quality we were developing in relation to suffering that would arise. And anything that would arise, quite frankly, just the whole field of, you know, feeling and mental contents as well. But actually, equanimity is the fourth Brahmavihara, and it's quite a sublime practice. It's quite a subtle practice. So much of the time I felt that I was just trying to be equanimous. Maybe I wasn't actually equanimous. It was just you're trying to be a little bit more steady with what arises. But actually, if you look at the Brahmaviharas, they start with love and kindness, and then compassion, and then mudita, and then equanimity. And when I've been practicing metta intensively, I've found that sometimes they naturally morph that way. You start off with metta, but then it at some point changes to compassion when it encounters maybe a person who's suffering. And eventually the mind sort of stands back with this feeling of, yeah, there's so much suffering in the world. And whilst I care very much about it, you know, the heart is not closed. The heart is not aloof. I don't like that word, aloof. And the heart is certainly not impartial, like as in not caring. But there is a sense of perspective, and there is a sense of acceptance around how far we can really help, you know? So I think there's something about compassion definitely leading towards peace. Yeah, absolutely. So another comment in the chat, and possibly a question. No, not a question, from the chair. Sometimes we can just turn things around. Venerable, what you said about being grateful for food that is offered when we're feeling greedy for the food is a good example of this. Yeah, absolutely. And especially in daily life, especially with the coarser hindrances, I would say, where it's really observable and you see, oh, I'm just thinking in a way that's not helping me right now. I don't need to think in this way. And I think if you don't have other tools, you might know you're not meant to think in that way, but then you're like, well, how do I think, right? You can't just stop thinking. So instead, you put in another thought instead. And that's what the first method of substitution is about. The Buddha actually says you take out a coarse peg with a fine peg. You can't just take that coarse peg out completely. You know, a peg is like, I think in Santi Monastery, actually in New South Wales, we used to make paths through the forest, and you'd have to sort of flatten a little bit of ground up a hill, and then you'd have to put a sort of piece of wood against it and then put some wooden pegs in to keep it in place. So I kind of get what he means by a peg. You know, it would be used to kind of fix things together. And if you want to remove something that's already in a hole, or you have to kind of push it out with something smaller. Yeah. So he likens that to using another thought, which is more refined, to displace or replace a coarser thought. So that can be very, very helpful, especially if you've, say, cultivated wholesome thoughts to a particular individual and then you have an irritated thought towards them. You can go back to those other thoughts that you've already had about them, and they're just right there. So it's really good to kind of keep on having thoughts of gratitude throughout the day and reflecting on people's qualities and, oh, this person's eyes are so bright and this person's asking great Dhamma questions and look at how this person's so attentive and look at this person's joy or this person's, I don't know, equanimity. I do this all the time. I mean, throughout the day, actually, because it's what brings me joy in what I do, especially when I'm running around busy. And especially after having done that for too long alone, you know, I can very, very easily see how blessed I am to have good people around. And that just makes it very hard to have ill will. I don't think I ever feel ill will. I sometimes feel tired and I sometimes think, oh gosh, I don't know if I can answer another question. But I don't remember having ill will towards anyone in this monastery, actually. I'm not saying I'm free from ill will. Yeah, but here people are so good. May the positive energy created, not just by this sutta discussion, but by all kind actions, words, and thoughts, past, present, and future, contribute to relieving the suffering of all beings now and for all time to come. And there is a thought of kindness, a thought of goodwill, a thought of harmlessness. Tibetan mind training is very helpful with heavy stuff. Very good. I don't know anything about that, but I'm happy that you have discovered that it helps you with heavy stuff. That's wonderful. Yeah. So anything else to say about this from anybody at all? Maybe we should look at the beautiful part of this, which is, after we become placid, settled, and focused on it, the mind is well departed, well developed, well emerged, and well liberated, and well detached from all these things. And they do not feel that feeling. That means it doesn't arise anymore. I don't know if the feeling is related to those states of mind or the actual feverish, distressful, and feverish feelings. I think it's probably around the feelings that arise with those taints, with those fetters, with those defilements, that we don't long any more feel those things. But also it can mean that we don't feel the ill will. We don't actually have thoughts of harmfulness or intentions of harmfulness arising anymore. So this is really, again, very encouraging, you know, that there is a way to come out of these completely. And I think the sutta is going quite deep, you know, certainly more than just, you know, cultivating wholesome states, because it is talking about overcoming the fetters and seeing through identity view, basically changing our view and eventually becoming free from all the fetters and breaking through conceit to make an end of suffering. So these things relate to the arahat, which is really wonderful. And of course, we have the whole Eightfold Path to help us with this. It's not that one sutta is going to be enough for most of us here. But if we really wanted to keep going into depth with it, we'd probably find that it encompassed much of the Dhamma. And it's all related to the Eightfold Noble Path, and we need every factor of that path. So some suttas will highlight one or two factors, others will highlight others. But eventually we need to be able to practice these teachings in every situation in our lives. So any more questions, comments? You know what Ajahn Brahm says, the three C's? Questions, not really a C. Questions, comments, or complaints? You can disagree with the sutta.
Should be four C's.
Which is the fourth? Compliments. Very good. Questions, comments, complaints, or compliments to the Dhamma. So you're practicing it already. You changed from complaint to compliment. It's amazing how positive mind beats positive thoughts. Yeah. Good. Wow. You're all very quiet. We usually talk right till the last moment. Okay. Haha, that's an interesting one. You're trying to ask me my secrets. Dear Venchanda, do you choose the sutta to discuss before the session starts, or do you choose it based on the energy of the group? I'm asking because I always have the feeling that the sutta we discussed is directly speaking to my present state of mind. There lies the genius of the Buddha, not of my choice. But to answer your question, I do think that it's a combination. I do choose it sort of before it starts, but only just before it starts, usually like an hour or something. And it's curious, but I do have this trust in the Dhamma that you sort of are gauging a little bit what might be appropriate. And I don't say that I have psychic powers that I can know that. But I'm kind of just looking through suttas and seeing if they could fit, seeing how they might speak to people, seeing if it's maybe a bit too dry or a bit too, I don't know, formulaic or technical or even a little bit something we've done before, right? So definitely, I mean, with a group that you've known for a long time, which changes, new people come, but there's a sort of evolution, I think, in people's understanding and in the kind of suttas that I want to bring across. And I try and choose ones that speak to me and ones that give a good variety, I suppose. But yeah, it's wonderful that it's speaking to you and to your present state of mind. And hopefully, because it's a discussion, that is more the case, because it's not just coming from me and my reflections, it's coming from everyone else's as well. And I think groups tend to be a bit connected to each other. I mean, firstly, that you're here in the first place shows you're sort of connected to this kind of way of understanding the Dhamma. So you're connected to each other, you're quite good friends, good spiritual friends. But also when we're around one another, we tend to tune in, I would say. Yeah. So there's a couple more comments in the chat. I'll just read through those and then we'll gradually wind up. What are your thoughts on metta meditation with visualization with a sensual object like flowers or kittens? If I bring a beautiful form or object to mind in order to give, that's okay. Or do we focus on light and formless metta? I think it's perfectly okay, actually, as long as it's not an object that brings about sensual craving or lust, especially. So not something or someone who you have an attraction towards. But something that's lovely, something that's beautiful is going to give rise very easily to metta, and we want to start with what's easy in metta meditation. So that's really good. But of course the quality of metta is that it gradually becomes so strong that it can expand and include things that are not easy to love as well, things that are difficult, but we don't start with that most of the time. There is an exception in the suttas where it says that, actually it's not even an exception. It's one place that the Buddha gives an order of who to practice with. And he says that one has resentment towards a person and starting with them, one develops thoughts of loving kindness. So that's quite interesting, because there he seems to be saying, don't let those thoughts of resentment set in, thoughts of ill will set in. So, that doesn't mean in deep meditation necessarily, and it depends on our state of mind, but sometimes we can do that in our daily life. I mean, this is a whole other discussion, and I'm not sure I'm going to have time to go into it in detail, but we're going to do some metta meditation tomorrow anyway. So if you can come along to that or follow some of the recordings, because there I do usually ask you to start with yourself or a loved person or something. I'm focusing on light and formless metta. I think not until you've had it fairly well embodied, until you've felt metta through the body. And then you don't even have to focus on light and formless metta. It becomes more and more refined and more subtle, if you like. So you might actually have lights arising, and you'll know that they're just not random lights, but they're related to the metta. It's almost like you're seeing metta through your mental eye. So, but it's an emotion, it's a feeling, and I think metta works really well when it's embodied. Yeah. Someone else has come in. We live in a violent society, full stop. I'm going to pause there. What did my mum sometimes call me? Contrary? But is it really true? Is it really true? I mean, look at this room. Look at the people around me anyway. Look at the people right outside on the street. I hope it's not violent there, but most of the time it's not. When you go to the supermarket, are people violent? I don't know. Most of the time not, but I know what you mean. How can these values be taught to the younger generation in school or in society? Control ill will, harming others. Apply the values in practice. Yeah, I think as this sort of saying, actually learning to be able to recognize ill will, first of all, not control it so much. I don't think the Buddha says control, but just see it arising and notice the feverishness of it. Notice the, what does it call it? Distressful, feverish nature of ill will. Because when we notice that, when we actually feel it in our bodies, we actually feel that it's, you know, causing our heart to go fast, or it's causing us to feel really tight, or it's causing us to have really harmful speech and think really miserable thoughts. Then in that observing, there's already a kind of perspective on it. It's like, oh, this is not good for me, right? And then practicing the opposites. I mean, how can they be taught to the younger generation in schools? I think having good examples, you know, having teachers who are kind and not controlling, not using the stick or anything like that, who encourage rather than punish, parents who do the same, you know, and who also, I think part of it is giving space for the difficult emotions. If we immediately suppress them, it's quite harmful. I mean, a couple of my friends have young children and they do have a lot of tantrums, you know. They say things that are really shocking sometimes to their parents. Like one of my friends said to his dad, "You don't belong in this family." 7 years old in a fit of rage. But they kind of, I mean, sometimes it's unpleasant, but they also are able to laugh. And one of the things I've said to my friend, and she's realized for herself, is that because he feels safe, he's able to express his anger in that way to the ones who love him. And that's actually okay, because he's learning to have those emotions normalized, and he's learning to see an antidote in his parents. They're not getting angry. They're not rising to it. The other thing he said to my friend, she tried to put into bed a little bit early, 7 years old, "You're killing me." That was so funny. And this is a very bright, very kind, very friendly little one, and really well behaved at school, really polite and everything. But, you know, we all have these different emotions, so it has to be a place for that as well. Yeah, so it's really, I think the only way we can really do it is to be good role models, honestly. And of course, if we could have classes on ethics and, you know, behavior, it'd be wonderful. I think it'd be a great thing to do. But if you're involved in school policy, bring it up. But it shouldn't be just taught as a do this, don't do that. That won't go deep enough, I think. Yeah. So I'll come to you, Suzanne, if it's very short. If it's longer, then yeah, it needs to be quite short because I usually overrun and I'm very tired today. So yeah, I'm kind of wondering if you wouldn't mind waiting. It's much easier to read something from the chat. Maybe you could summarize that way in the chat if you want. You're looking like it's a bit more meaty than that. I'll read this one in the chat and then we'll see how we go. I also belong to a group which uses a form of meta meditation based on imagination and color. This group is to help the world and life on the planet and above. This meta meditation is good for developing loving kindness for both myself and the world. Great. If it works for you, wonderful. If you are going to be serious about meta meditation, I would just say really thorough practice that's helped me the most is when we are able to start applying it to all types of people, not to make it only imagination and color based or kind of all beings, because you can easily get into a nice feeling, all beings, it's a sort of theory. Try practicing it actually to someone you don't like and see if you still have metta. Not all at once, build up. But when you've got a lot of metta, just bring someone up that, okay, a neutral person perhaps. Because the aim of metta is not just feeling good. The aim of metta is to undermine ill will and really start to change that tendency deep inside. Okay. 2 minutes, Suzanne, can you? Or are you writing in the box now? I think you've written something.
Well, maybe I could. There's a metta meditation tomorrow?
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe I'll ask it after the meditation. Yes. It's more a meditation question, actually. Great. So it's better. Yeah.
Great. Okay. I'll make sure I end early enough for you to ask the question. You get first chance.
Thanks.
So last point in the box. Please don't keep writing in the box. I almost always start by envisioning one of my dogs. Her name is Netta. That makes it easier to move on to challenging objects. Beautiful. Excellent. Just find what works for you. And it's okay to go with something that really works and that you really enjoy for a long time, but don't get too much stuck in your comfort zone, because we're trying to overcome something pretty deep here, craving, ill will, or aversion and delusion. So, yeah, keep taking it deeper. I think you're all fantastic, and it's so wonderful to talk with you and to have so many perspectives on practice from this group. So it's really a privilege and a blessing. And I am a lot more energized right now, but the body is tired. I sound like Matthias, the body is tired, being very objective and matter of fact. So I will let you go. I think Manori needs to interrupt me at this point.
Thank you very much, Venerable, for the wonderful sutta discussion. And thank you all for all those questions. And we all learned from the questions and Venerable's answers and the discussions. And so, as you know, I come to just remind that the sutta discussion and all what Venerable is doing, these regular teachings, are offered on a donation basis in the spirit of generosity. And if you are able, please see in the donation link that I have put, and there are two ways to donate if you are able. There's financial donations. And in the financial donations, there are two ways, either the PayPal or the bank transfers. And always the other way is the regular shopping deliveries or vouchers, shopping or supermarket vouchers. Very helpful because sometimes people live far away and then they can do that. Without coming to do a dana. If you want to do a dana, please contact team@anukampaproject.org. There is an Amazon wish list as well. I don't know whether it is full, Venerable. Do we have more things?
There's not a lot more now. There might be just a couple more things, like we put on there, for example, some pillowcase liners, and then we found we probably didn't order enough or something like that. But it'll be small things now. So it's
have a look.
Take up of that list, and the generosity of this community has been absolutely amazing. So I really want to thank you for that. And I also want to thank you because we do have apparently quite a lot of food people lined up to offer supermarket shops. So in case you can't get a slot, you know, it's, yeah. I mean, food is something that is actually okay for us at the moment. And we do have other projects coming up. So we want to build an office. And we're going to talk to you about that with Ajahn Brahm in a couple of weeks' time, February the 15th, for anyone.
Yeah, 15th February. Please check the website, Facebook or newsletter, Ajahn Brahm's online Zoom event and the auction. Yes. And then next week, starting Bhante Suchato's events.
Yes. I somehow managed to exit myself from the full screen. Okay, good. So, yes. Lots of events happening for those nearby. Yeah, we are having an evening tea and lunch also with Bhante Suchato on. Do I have to be spotlighted? I can't see everybody. Oh, well, I can see myself. on the 3rd of February. So if you are local-ish, you're welcome to come at lunchtime. If you can bring a dish, that's great, because if I invite everyone and only a few people bring dishes, then some might not get any food. I can assure you me and Bhante will, but all of you have to eat. Otherwise, tea time, you're very welcome, means 5:30. What else? I'm sure there's lots of other things. You can check out our website. Anyway, I think I'll let you go now. Thank you very much for all your lovely comments in the chat. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.